Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein. This week and next week, we have a very fascinating program, Safeguarding Our Community, How to Deal with Perpetrators and Super Predators. We will have on Rabbi Aaron Sorcher of a Rav in Detroit. We will have Rabbi Ron Eisman from Passaic, New Jersey. We will have, this week, Mutzi Weiss, a victim of Mondrowitz. Next week, we will continue the program. We will have Rabbi Tzvi Weiss of Baltimore. We will have Dr. Shira Berkowitz, a famous psychologist whose expertise is safeguarding children. And we will have a victim of Yuri Coco by the name of David Fromwitz, two very brave, courageous victims. Again, dealing with perpetrators, both halachically and hashkafically. Before we say something about the parsha, I would like to say that briefly, you know, the Shulchan Aruch in Shin Lamed Aleph in Yeridaya talks about those who would damage our community. We've built something very beautiful here in America. When my father went to yeshiva, he said there were a choice of two, maybe three yeshivas to go to. He said he dated my mother. He said there were just a handful of frumer girls in America. Today, we have built something special. We've built something reverent. We've built something venerable, sacred. We have hundreds of yeshivas. We have, and our chesed, the web of our community, the arvus, the sense of Yisrael Arevim Zelazer. We have Achnasas Kala, Taim Chay Shabbos. We have renewal. We'll give you a kidney. If you need a kidney, they'll find you, match you with. We have relief. If you need counseling, they'll find you a psychologist for free. We have Bikur Cholim houses where you can stay for free. We have, they'll send you food in the hospital. We've built a web. Nobody feels lost. But sadly, every time you've built something sanctified, valuable, sacred, you have affinity fraud. Affinity fraud are those who come in under the guise, they look like us, they act like us, but they're really coming to drill a hole in the boat. Now, this is the week of Noach. Imagine you're on a cruise ship, and one guy says, in my room, I'm just going to drill a hole out to the ocean. You have those who try to take down our community. It could be by being sexual deviants and those who molest. Nobody molests one. Your average molester molests 40 children. It could be Ponzi schemers. It could be people who create great chilul Hashems that damage our ability of meistis to get taivis from the government, to have reach, etc. So how do we deal? So the Shulchan Aruch and Shin Lamed Aleph says that somebody who is a perpetrator of anything that's chayiv nidu, which is minor, is being mocking Rabbanan, Shulchan Aruch says, we throw him out of the community. And it says, but where will he daven? So the Shulchan Aruch says, we don't care if he becomes fry. We have to protect the community. It's our number one thing. Pikuach nefesh uv tzibur. Shulchan Tziv Dalid brings from Shuvas Rav Palti Goyen, he says, to protect our community, we can take the perpetrator, we can throw their children out of school, we can ask their family to leave shul, we cannot maul their children, and we can we cannot bury them. If they have a mace in their family, we don't bury the mace. So Chazal took protection of the community, of the tzibur, very seriously. So we'll speak to a number of Rabbanim and say, well, how do we deal with these super predators? Before we go on to that, I would like to just say a small thought on the Parsha. This is Parshas Noach. And Noach is really one of my heroes. He's somebody, what do we know about Noach? He's called Noach Ish Tzadik Tamim, a perfect tzadik. So you say, why is he my hero, Lichtenstein? We know you're far from perfect. Right? So think of it. What do we know about Noach? Well, we know he was a very kind person, right? He invented the plow to make people's lives easier. He was a techno, right? He was an industrialist. He was, you know, interested in, he created the iPhone of his generation. But he also struggled. We know that Noach, he built the Teva for 120 years, right? He didn't believe in it. He actually had to collapse. He had to be pushed. He stumbled his way into the Teva. It's amazing. For 120 years, what does the Chazal say? Ve'esrim shana hayanoach notei arazim v'kaitetzan. For 120 years, he planted great cedars. That's what he built the teva out of, and he would cut them down. He made it yet his lumber mill. They said, "Why? Lama kedain?" He said, "Kach amar et alma, who maisi mabula al alma." He's bringing a flood on the world. He's unhappy with the way things are going. Amrle in Aisi Mabula, they're only going to bring it al Beisa de Hugavra. So he's 100, and what happens? It starts raining, and Noach will not go into the Teva. Rashi says, Miktane Emana. He was a man of small, of limited faith. We see, he has a son. Look at his children. Would have you done a Shidduch with him? He has one son, he's called Cham, darkness, the count of darkness, the father of slavery, father of evil, right? We have Yafis, beauty, physical, narcissism. He had one good son, shame. Didn't have. And what do we know about Noach? He leaves the Teva. He's so traumatized. First thing he does is he becomes an alcoholic. He has an addiction issues. And the Torah calls him Noach Ish Tzadik Tamim, a perfect tzadik. Amazing! Everything we would not be Meshadach with, the Torah calls Ish Tamim, Tzadik Tamim, and he's the only person in the whole Tanakh, all Chavdalat Svarim, who's called a Ish Tamim. Imagine that, Tzadik Tamim. And I think there's a lesson here, a very powerful lesson for me, maybe for you too. And the Torah tells us, stumble your way to greatness. Babble, bungle, babble daily, fail daily your way, on your way to greatness. He built it and he didn't believe, and he built it and he just kept stumbling his way. He didn't give up. He was tenacious. He stumbled his way to greatness. Because the Torah tells us that more important, the definition of a tzaddik is not somebody who's holy and perfect, but somebody who's trying to be perfect. Trying to be perfect is the definition of a tzaddik. And boy, did Noach try hard. Among all the mockery, the ridicule, the laughter, the litzonis, he just kept going about it. So the Torah defines what's a tzaddik tamim? Not the perfect guy who never made a mistake, who's wonderful, but shiva yipol tzaddik who come, stumbling constantly, failing constantly, right into the teva. Right to be the father of mankind. The Gemara in Baba Kama says in Daf Tzadik Beis, the Gemara says, a ben Noach is chayiv, shahaya loy lilmoid v'loy lamad. A ben Noach who does an avera, who should have taught him? He says he should have enlightened himself, he should have tried. That's the message of Noach. We should try harder. We don't have to achieve the stumbling our way. That itself is the concept. If you stumble your way, you are a tzaddik tamim. I don't give up. I will continue trying. I will err. I will babble. I will bungle. I will be miktane amana. I will land in the teva, and I will be the father of mankind. Stumble your way to greatness. Fabulous message. Let's go to the phone. We have some fabulous guests.
We have on the phone with us from Detroit, formerly the Rav of Whispering Pines in Lakewood. Today he's the Magid Shir of Shas Illuminated, Harav Rav Aaron Sorsha. Welcome, Rav Aaron.
Yes, thank you, Rav Aaron.
So, Rav Aaron, we're discussing an issue which is very prevalent, I shouldn't say very prevalent, but it's unfortunately somewhat prevalent in our community, where we have predators, and they can be both sexual predators, they could be financial predators, because financial predators mean we have people who, you know, they're welcome in our shuls, and they create relationships, and people start trusting them with their money, you know, it's the Chahemisha and Unzara, and it happens in every community, it happens in Jewish communities, in Christian, it's not something that's endemic to our community, but they become predators, and they prey us, either financially or on our children, etc. And the question is how to deal with these people. Now, I think you're somewhat in an ironic situation because a member of your family was a victim of a predator, and and I understand that you did what you could to address these issues and try to remove the predator from the community, and you were somewhat in the unusual situation where it seems you were uncomfortable and left the community, even though your family was in effect the victim here. Could you give us a little color on both from a personal or maybe from a hashkaf or halachic view of how you would deal with this as both a Rav and a very big Talmud Chacham?
Yeah, well, in my case, it's true. A son of mine, we had learned, was the victim of sexual abuse by someone who was a camp counselor of his. The first thing that I did was I actually confronted him directly, and my message to him was that I'm not out to destroy him, I'm not out to hurt him, but we have a responsibility, both of us, that this doesn't happen again. And in order to work that out, the only possible way is that he should leave his job. He was a teacher in a school, and he was a counselor in camp, and also get help, get therapy, and I wanted to direct him to where he could get that help. Initially, he was cooperative. He didn't deny anything. He admitted it to me and to the rabbanim that I brought him to, and to the professionals that I brought him to. And I was under the impression that this situation was at least somewhat resolved. Subsequently...
Wait, let me interrupt you. Why did you feel the responsibility to remove him from the community? I know it may sound like a sort of a silly question, but I'm asking you both from a halacha, a hashgafa, from a neighborhood, why would you say that?
Because sexual abuse is very, very damaging to the children. It's always a very big trauma. It could lead even to suicide. It could definitely lead to drug abuse, which also could be a clear pikuach nefesh question because of drug overdose. And drug abuse anyway is, as we all know, it's extremely damaging. Even without that, it leads to spiritual alienation. Many children who went off the derech was a direct result of sexual abuse. It does lead to failed marriages, and it's definitely something which the victim has to deal with usually for the rest of their life. Now, I don't mean to stigmatize the victims. It's definitely possible that with help and with encouragement, the victim could recover from it and could be a very fine, productive, firm individual. But the damage is immense. And there's very rarely such a thing as one victim. If someone was involved in sexual abuse with one child, all the children that he is in contact with are at risk. And it was partially Samad Adam Riecha to do something. I believed, maybe I'm a bit naive and optimistic, I believed that by speaking to him, because I knew the perpetrator, and other than this tremendous problem he had, he did seem to me like somebody who I could work with. Someone who is, if you could call him that, essentially a good person who means well, but he's just completely, you know, his compulsive behavior, completely under the control of the Yetzirah. Initially, he did give me that impression, too. He expressed a lot of remorse and basically acknowledged that he has a big problem and did sincerely want to get help for it. It's just he backed out. He backed out because there were people that gave him very bad advice. There were people that he protested his innocence to, and strangely enough, they just took his word for it without asking me, without asking the people he was dealing with, or if they did ask other people he was dealing with, they apparently ignored him. He admitted the whole thing. It didn't make any sense at all. But after a while, after a few months, he was very brazen. He refused to give up his jobs. He refused to do anything that we asked. I sent a message to him. I didn't want to talk to him again because he didn't want to talk to me. I sent a message that I'm going to have to go to the authorities. When the message was ignored, someone else tried to work with him. Whatever the case was, about a month later, I went to the prosecutor's office and they arrested him.
So, Rabbi Sosha, you know, there's a letter from Rabbi Yashiv and that you need raglayim ladavar. Would you say that the admission of the person would constitute raglayim ladavar?
In almost every case. The admission of the person, in almost every case.
Okay.
I can't say absolutely across the board, but if he's confronted and he admits it, that's really, really powerful. So to go afterwards and say, well, he just admitted it because he was scared and this and that, generally speaking, almost every case doesn't make any sense at all.
Right.
That was particularly because the information that he gave corresponded with the information that the victim gave. So it really didn't make any sense.
And what happened subsequently?
Well, subsequently, there were people in the community that agitated and that didn't rest and did a tremendous amount, you know, put a tremendous amount of time and effort into a campaign, basically to both come with a two-pronged attack, that A, there's absolutely no evidence that he did it, and it's just, you know, the whole thing is crazy, and B, even had he been a molester, this is not the appropriate way of dealing with it.
So they made your life difficult.
Yeah, but I didn't engage with them at all. And that's the way it was. And we did end up moving from Lakewood. But it would not have been a problem for me to stay there. It's just that there were members of my family that, because of the treatment they had by certain individuals in Lakewood, they just didn't feel comfortable being in Lakewood anymore. They still don't. And we moved. And
So let me ask you a question now. Extrajudicial from your case, do you believe that when somebody who's a predator moves to a community, that this person should be disallowed from shul, that this person's, you know, like, how much harchaka should our communities have towards people who have...
If the rabbanim of the community, the leaders of the community, know that he is indeed a predator, and that means he's a danger. And the community has to do whatever they can to protect the children from this danger.
Now, let me ask you another question. And would it be fair to say, Rav Sorsha, as somebody who's I've seen your svarim, I've seen beautiful svarim that you've written, is it fair to say that people who protect the predator and who absurdly make the person who is going ahead and trying to remove the predator, but certainly those who protect them, that rather than being over loisame dal dam reyecha, they are being over on, they are actually being, you know, what's the opposite of loisame dal dam? They are being oime dal dam reyecha. They are in effect being, they are assisting a roidif. Where there's a concept of hashavas aveda, they are being ma'abed aveda. Where there's loisame dal dam reyecha, they're being ma'abed dam reyecha.
Usually they will claim... Most cases, they will claim that there was no evidence, that there's two sides to the story, whatever the case would be. The problem is like this. The main problem is, you know, the people who do it, the derech kol, I don't consider them to be bad people inherently. The problem is that there's not enough awareness, and it's not internalized enough, the tremendous sakana that a molester engenders. It's just not in the consciousness of the people enough. If they would realize that, they wouldn't be able to rationalize and justify their actions the way they do. You know, Reb Chanan Wasserman quotes Reb Chaim Soloveitchik as saying, someone wrote an article which was damaging to the Torah cause, and someone tried to justify it by saying that he really means well. He's just a foolish person. He doesn't realize what he's doing. And Reb Chanan quotes Reb Chaim as saying, but in his own affairs, he's not foolish. In something that he cares about, he's not foolish. If he's foolish about Yiddishkeit, that means he doesn't care about Yiddishkeit enough. It's not his own thing. If people would consider the plight of these children, if they would have the empathy, the same type of empathy that we see constantly, like by Levi Klotsky, or by the three Bachrim that were kidnapped by Chevron, or whatever it is, there's a lot of empathy, but somehow it doesn't get translated into the children that are victimized in sexual abuse. If people would have that empathy, they'd think straight. They wouldn't have these rationalizations and justifications. They'd understand themselves what it is they'd have to do. Another point. When question is like this, when an accusation is made and the accusation is denied, someone claims this and this person's a molester, the perpetrator, alleged perpetrator, says, no, I'm not, this person's making it up. So the community should give both of them a cheskes kashrus at that point. At that point, if it's not clear, so okay, you can't turn against somebody just because an accusation was made. He has a cheskes kashrus. We don't know. There is a lemecha shmir boy. There's a certain amount of protection you have to have anyway, but you can't turn against him and attack him if it's not clear to you that he's actually guilty. But on the other hand, to attack his accuser, to attack the victim and the family for making the accusation and doing what they do when they claim that they know, is also completely wrong. They have a cheskes kashrus as well. That's a problem sometimes that people get confused about. They feel they have to take a side. So they decide, either he's right or I think he's right. You don't have to take a side necessarily if you don't know. So as far as you're concerned, they both have a cheskes kashrus. But then...
Now, two more questions, Rabbi Sosha. When somebody reports somebody to a prosecutor, as somebody who's been this firsthand, does the prosecutor say, okay, you said it, I'm arresting, I'm convicting, or before they arrest, is there a thorough...
Well, the prosecutor will definitely investigate. At least the prosecutors are trained in talking to the victim and understanding if the victim is credible. I can't say that any time there's arrest that's for sure. You could already assume that the person's guilty. That's not true. But it's not, the arrest is usually not made just on a whim, usually there is, there's definitely some investigation that's done beforehand.
And so let me ask you a question. If it was a three-year-old, the mother says, you know, my three-year-old, and a little three-year-old is sort of, you know, makes a few, which I understand has happened a number of times, mm-hmm. would a prosecutor rush to arrest, or would they be a little smarter than that?
Most of the times they'd be a little smarter than that.
Yeah.
They definitely would. You know,
let me ask you another question, Sosha. This is a little bit beyond the topic that you're discussing. When you have a predator who has been defanged, so to say, he's been exposed and defanged, but somebody who's done an extensive amount of damage, creditors who maybe 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 children. I mean, we've had, you know, Mondrowitz as victims we've had here on this. He molested 100 boys, numerous, more than a few have committed suicide. Somebody like that moves into a community. He's not a danger anymore. Should the community be merachik this person as Laman Yishmu v'yiro, or at that point there's no reason anymore to be merachik somebody like this?
It has to be decided on a case-by-case basis. It can't get
I'm giving you a case basis.
In an extreme case where it's 100% clear to the leaders of the community that that's the case, it would seem to me that it would be appropriate to be merachik totally. It would seem to me that way. But it really has to be decided on a case-by-case basis. I can't, in most cases, even a molester that's been exposed is dangerous. As long as he's interacting fully with the community, that means when he asks a child, do you want a soda, and makes a relationship with him, no one's going to stop him. It's not like people are going to say, okay, you could come to the shul, you could be, everything's perfect. But as soon as I see him talking to a child and smiling at them and giving him a gift or whatever it is, alarm bells will ring. That's just not the way people are. So I don't know if there's such a thing as a defanged molester. If the molester is interacting in the community, that's a danger.
Yeah.
The point is, what has to be done, besides that we have to have more empathy for the victim and thereby be more aware of the danger, is that the victims and the family, like in my case, have to have, even though it's very hard to ask them of this, but it's just so important, they have to have mesiras nefesh here. They have to realize that they're really the only ones that could do anything. If the victim chooses to remain anonymous, does not want to go to the police because maybe people will find out about it, or maybe there will be some opposition, and does whatever they can to protect their own children and allows the molester the leeway to just go to anyone else, that's wrong. And even though it's hard to ask that of somebody, but there's nothing we could do. It's like knowing about a terrorist attack and saying, okay, it would be very difficult for me to stop the terrorists. It would be difficult and dangerous, so I'm just going to move out with my family and not tell anyone because of all the difficulties that I'm going to encounter. You can't, the motivation that the victim and family should have is not the motivation that you mentioned, that, you know, it's wrong, it's not just, it's you know, how could such a rush be allowed in the community? The main motivation they should have is
to protect other children. Yep.
And if they go with that motivation and they stick to that, and that's their own thing, but they're rock solid. I'm not going to rest until I feel that the danger is, I did whatever I could do to remove the danger and not be sidetracked by protecting their own children. Or, you know, let's say there's a Rebbe in the school that's a predator. So very often, the student, that the victim, would contact somebody, contact the Rav, insist on being anonymous. The Rav should contact the principal, tell them an owl about it. And the reason why they're doing it is just because the victim wants to continue attending that school and wants the Rebbe out. Well, what's the principal going to do in that case? There's very little he could do other than telling the Rebbe, go find a job in another school. Then the victim's happy, and the principal avoided a confrontation, which he can't hold his end of it, because how does he know that what the victim says is right? He doesn't even know who the victim is. So because of that, the predator goes to another school, and it happens again, and it happens again. If the victim would say, no, I'm not going to rest until this guy is not a Rebbe altogether, or until he has no connection to the children altogether. Very, very bare minimum, he should get a job, nothing to do with children, but that's bare minimum. You know what I'm saying? And I don't mind if what will take is that I have to have some exposure, so be it. But I can't let this happen again. Then we'd be a lot closer to solving the problem.
Yeah.
Now, people say I shouldn't blame the victim. Blaming the victim means you don't blame the victim for being victimized. Of course not. But if the victim, after being victimized, doesn't go out positively and do what he can to make sure it doesn't happen to other children, and if his family doesn't, and people who advise them, well-meaning people, no, you got to care about yourself. Don't worry about anyone else. That's not your achrayus. That's wrong. There's no one else who could do it. There's a terrible threat, and he's the only one that could do it. He's the only one that can take care of it. How could you tell him only care about yourself? It doesn't make sense. You got to care about everyone else. That's the problem. So the victim's acting out of anger and just saying, no, how could he do such a terrible thing and get away with it? And that's what he acts at. The result might not be good. The victim should be acting, the motive should be, I can't let this happen to anyone else. It's a tough order, but I think that's what the Torah requires.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Sosha. It was an honor having you on with us.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, Devin.
Take care, Kalta.
We have on the phone with us, from Passaic, New Jersey, Rabbi Ron Yitzchak Eisenman. Welcome, Rabbi Eisenman.
Hello. How are you?
Baruch Hashem. So, Rabbi Eisenman, you have somewhat of an expertise in dealing with people who've sort of crossed the line. This is what I've been told, with either molestation or other issues. Could you fill us in a little bit of your experience in that?
Well, first of all, just to clarify, I don't claim to have expertise, and I don't know if I'm known as an expert in anything. So I just want to, I would be glad to speak, but I don't think I'd be necessarily considered some sort of expert in anything.
Okay.
But by that being said, I don't know, it was probably about 7-8 years ago, unfortunately, there was a fellow who moved here from Brooklyn, and I was told by very reputable sources that he had molested children in Brooklyn. And subsequent to my own inquiry, that seemed to be corroborated. Nobody denied it. So I was involved in informing the community. And from that, I've had some involvement with people who have been molested or those type situations.
So let me ask you a halacha shayla. Maybe hashkaf shayla, miksh hashkaf and halacha. Somebody moves into a city and they have had, and I'm sort of lumping it together, they were either known as a molester, and well, they've created a huge chilul Hashem. This happened recently in a Shalai Davindin with somebody who created just a huge chilul Hashem Davindin, or you know, one of these Ponzi schemers, etc. What is the? What should the neighbor's attitude be? Look, everybody needs some place to daven. Everybody needs some place to send their kids to school. Or should the attitude be, "Ubiarta rami kirbecha"? We have, when you have something precious and valuable, you put a fence up around it to guard it. And we have a beautiful and a special and a holy community. And when people come in who defame it, who damage it, who try to uproot it, we should be more aggressive about it. What would the Rav's opinion be?
Okay, it's a very good question. I think one obviously each case is different, and each case has its own complexities and its own nuances. But I think one thing which needs to be clarified is actually what is the opinion or what is the stance of the person who's, be it suspected or has been verified as being the quote-unquote Ra, the Ra Mekirbecha. I mean, honestly, I think that makes all the difference in the world. If we're dealing with an individual who's denying it, and on the other hand, it's a kola de lo pascha, meaning it's a rumor which, I don't want, rumor is not a good word, but it's a, even if I don't have actual witness testimony, but it seems to be substantiated, or it seems to be a widely held understanding among people, and the person is in total denial, so obviously the response would be a more aggressive type of trying to distance ourselves from such an individual. On the other hand, if the person was more compliant and was more admitting that, and they were interested in being helped or being in some ways cooperative, so then I think the response, you know, I think there are possibilities in all areas of the halacha to try to work with the person in some sort of system which would guarantee everybody's feeling safe. On the other hand, wouldn't necessarily just turn the person to another neighborhood. I mean, honestly, in many cases, as you probably yourself know, you know, if Shul X throws the person out, so he can just move. If they don't like him in Flatbush, he can move to Borough Park. If they don't like him in Borough Park, he can move to Lakewood. He can move to a different part of Lakewood. He can move to Muncie. I mean, I don't think necessarily pushing the person from neighborhood to neighborhood is the solution either. I don't know.
So why is a community do, and I don't know if it starts at the lay people or the Rabbanim, why are we missing the sense of outrage at the perpetrators? And we'll hear one of our victims today talk about the multiple suicides that this causes. Why are we missing that sense of communal lockstep outrage, and so have so much empathy towards the perpetrators? I mean, forgetting about just molesters, you have people who do heinous crimes against our communities, and they basically know, you know what, I'll come for a few weeks, I'll feel uncomfortable, and then I'll get Elias again, I'll be back in my seats again, and everybody will look the other way. If they knew, you're out of the community, your kids will not be accepted to schools, you will never be allowed into a shul again, it could be a very a powerful deterrent. So why do we have so much empathy towards the perpetrators and so little for the victims, the families of those who committed suicides, those who were robbed? those who the great part of us who are humiliated when a lot of these things show up in the papers, and anybody with yarmulke or frum gets sort of tarred with the same brush. Why are we missing that sense of outrage?
I just want to clarify. Are you asking in general, not specifically crimes which involve sexual?
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had recently we're going to have on the show this fellow Dweck, who committed terrible crimes, right? Shows up in Baltimore, puts his kids in the yeshiva, rents a house in middle of, you know, Main Street, and Dubinich, here I am. What I did in Jersey. Now I'm in Baltimore. I got a new start. And we're going to hear a very prominent, the Bezdin, said, okay, sure, no problem. Welcome. Until a few Rabbanim and a few very brave individuals stood up and said, no, you don't belong among us. You did too much damage to our community. Mm-hmm. You were a Maharis. Adas Mimana. You tried to be Oiker, Adas Mimana, like Lovan. So where is the outrage? Why are we missing that sense of outrage?
I do think, Mr. Lichtenstein, I think the bringing up that question, I think, has a lot to do with the answer to your very good question. You know, the reality is that, you know, you mentioned, and first of all, I think there is empathy, and I think the tide is turning. To be honest, even in the years that I've been involved, I think there are more rabbis and lay leaders. I think there's a total now recognition of everybody. I think most families and, you know, people of you still have young children, all, I think, Orthodox homes, from what I said, even in the Hasidic community, are talking to their children about, you know, never letting yourselves be touched. I think that many schools are instituting a total zero tolerance policy. They are telling even Rebbeim, I can't ever see you or hearing that you've touched a child in any way. So I think there has been, an awakening. Is it enough? Probably never. It will be enough. But I do think that's important to state, that there has been more empathy, more caring. And even as you indicated, in that case, some people did stand. But nevertheless, that being the case, look, honestly, you know, if somebody says something about your brother and your brother tells you it's not true, I mean, you're faced, you're in a very difficult situation in your life. I think the answer is that we don't want to believe our heroes are really felons. We don't want to believe the man sitting next to you with a beard and payas or just with a yarmulke is an evil person. We're not taught to believe that in school. And if the person denies it, I mean, it's a very difficult situation for the community. I don't have a great answer, but I mean, there's a difficult situation here. I mean, there are cases, what is considered, you know, in the cases you mentioned, they're pretty clear, but there are individuals who,
Now, let's talk about that for a minute. You brought up a very interesting topic, the boys who were incarcerated in Japan. Do you think that was a worthy cause to raise money for? Let me try to do it this way. Does it make sense that we should free every Jewish criminal, rapist, murderer, pedophile, Ponzi schemer, because of the fact that they were the Jewish? In other words, does it say someplace in the Torah that because you're Jewish, you should not be penalized for your actions?
Obviously, we both know that it doesn't say that. But I would say, in a more general idea, honestly, is that I think you're raising the point that we as Jews should be, like Cy Sims would say, an educated consumer is our best customer. An educated Jew is our best Jew. I don't think, honestly, ads in newspapers should not be what directs you or me or any person that they give their charity donations. Frankly, I personally, any glossy ads, it's an automatic that I turn the page and go on. You know, just because probably around us, most of us live in neighborhoods where we can find people who we know are struggling. I think we should give it to those people, be it who they are, local Rabbanim, or who know the places, Aniyei Yircha. I mean, Chazal were very clear that first you look at your family, and first you look at those who live on your block, and then you lose in your neighborhood, and then you look at those who live in the Medina. And honestly, you know, the full-color glossy ads, even for their, you know, poor people, wherever they may be, that doesn't seem to be following the guidelines of Chazal. And as you mentioned correctly, I'm not exactly sure of, you know, even let's say the word pidyon shvuyim. Pidyon shvuyim is a halachic terminology. It's very unclear that that term applies any time, as you said, most probably it doesn't, or most probably, more often than not, it's a discussion among the poskim, like any other halachic concept. And probably it's much more limited in nature than the ad or the ad.
So Rabbi Eisman is discussing, I want to come back to, if it's in a preventative manner, we all agree that they should be policed. Now let's talk post facto. Somebody like the Dweck is already, you know, nobody's doing business with him, nobody's getting. He moves into your community, he moves down the block from you, and he wants to put his kids into your school and start davening in your shul. And I'm using him just as a, I'm going to call them sort of the super predators, like Hillary Clinton would say, those who do extensive damage. What is your attitude? Do you say, look, he's not a danger anymore, but he's caused such chil Hashem, so much damage, so much rubble, so much destruction to us as a people. He's lost his right. Or do you say, no, it's not my job, let him in? What would be your opinion?
It's interesting. I think there was a reform rabbi, I think his name was Kay or something like that, David Kay, in the Washington, D.C. area. He spent time for in a prison for, I think, alleged trying to prey on somebody via the internet, a minor. And when he came back to his, when he came back to his Reform congregation, they had actually had a vote in the congregation, and they voted as a congregation to deny him access to, even though he claimed he was a Baal Tshuva already, he said, I've done Tshuva. Nevertheless, they voted that such a person should be Arta Ra Mikirbecha. I think that's something that we should correctly consider. I think an individual who obviously could speak to the person, and if the person perhaps would want to make a plea publicly why he's a total repentant, and he totally, unfortunately, like the Hilchos Tshuva, regrets everything he did. I want to point out that we're dealing with sexual molestation, so then you have the idea of the recidivism of the crime, which involves a mental health issue, which the person can, as Rabbi Abraham J. Tversky would say, how do you know when an addict is lying, you know, when his lips are moving? So, I mean, I think you find that his, you know, despite his promises to the contrary, I think there are certain people we can no longer trust. But if you say it's a financial issue, if the person is totally repentant, to the extent that they would say, I no longer want, I will no longer get an aliyah, or I will do what it takes to get me back in shul. I will do what it takes. So then maybe there is room. But if the person comes defiantly with their head up and say, I never did anything wrong, and et cetera, of course I wouldn't allow such a person to be a part of the kehillah. I've asked people to leave for less.
Well, thank you very much, Rabbi Eisenman. It's been an honor having you on with us.
Well, thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
Perfect. Who is a yeshiva bacha, was a yeshiva bacha, probably still is a yeshiva bacha. His father was a Rebbe for 37 years in Telz, and he has quite an educational and a frightening story to share with us. Welcome, Mati.
Thank you. Thank you, David.
Mati, could you tell us your story?
Well, when I was younger, as you mentioned, I grew up, my father was a Rebbe in Telz Yeshiva in Chicago, and I was just one of those kids that, I didn't quite fit into the system, perhaps. Not a bad kid in any way, it just, sometimes you have kids who just have a little trouble fitting into the system. And, this was a very disturbing thing to my father. And so as a result, I think, you know, he throughout the years, he just went to different people to try to figure out how to sort of set me straight, I guess. And unfortunately, what that did is had me end up over by Avremel Mandarovitz, who was actually a family friend. We all, you know, he grew up in Chicago. He was a Talmud in the yeshiva by my father, and certainly was a very familiar person, and had a reputation for, you know, helping out kids in that situation. And so I had the privilege of going and spending some time with him over summer, and you know, that's where I ended up. And you know, of course, a very charming and charismatic person. He, you know, showed me the greatest time when I was in New York. Very fun. He gave me a ton of attention. I thought it was a tremendous experience. I, you know, soaked up every moment of it. And you know, of course, it's all a Hamish situation. So, you know, a familiar person to my father, and so, of course, it was no problem. I'd stay over at their house, etc. He had, of course, a large family. But what he neglected to tell my father, my parents, is that his entire family was up in a bungalow colony, and it was actually just me and him. And so, as a result, I found myself as a, you know, somewhat vulnerable young kid who's getting tremendously positive attention. But ultimately for the wrong reasons. And so when it was just me and him, he basically charmed and manipulated and groomed his way into earning my trust. And so therefore, unfortunately, put me in positions where ultimately I was molested by him. And
how old were you at the time?
I was about 13 or 14. Can't remember exactly the age, but 13, 14 area. And the crazy thing about it is that none of it was a negative experience. Even like when I found myself in a compromising situation with him, number one is I didn't really have the language. In other words, you know, any kind of discussion regarding, you know, anything of sexual nature was just, as in many yeshivisha households, it's just sort of like a bit of a taboo subject, sneeze, whatever it is. And plus the fact that it was just he showered me with so much attention, and so, it was like such a positive thing. He took me out to lunch, to dinner, to an amusement park. He was just like this cool guy. So when my limited imagination was telling me that something was problematic here, like in my head, I just sort of worked through it because I just said, I just sort of took this as very loving and attention, you know, and giving me, showering me with attention, a positive thing. And so really, when I came away from the whole situation, I didn't like walk out of there just with a ton of bricks on my shoulder. It wasn't really until a number of years later, I had actually, you know, gone to a bunch of different yeshivas, which ultimately did not work out so well, and then spent a couple of years by myself in Israel, you know, so about when I was 17 years old, I had come home. It was actually just around this time of year. It was Erev Sukkot. I came home for the first time in a couple of years. And I walked into shul on the first night of Yontif. And, of course, this was, it turned out that was 1984. So 1984 is actually when he fled. So it just coincidentally worked out that I walked into shul. He had already fled from New York and gone to Chicago. And so I saw him in shul, and you know, between Mincha and Marav, there was a break, and so as I started to walk over him to him, the whole thing just sort of flooded back into my head, the whole experience from years before, and I suddenly froze in my tracks because, you know, this whole repressed memory just sort of, you know, came to the front burner again. And of course, by then I'd been around the block a few times and learned a thing or two about how people are supposed to behave, especially around kids, and I froze in my tracks, and I realized what had happened to me, and of course, you know, I spun around and started crying, went out of shul, came home, and, you know, of course, my mother opened the door, very surprised that I had come home so early. I had just essentially left, and she asked me, she could see I was upset, so she asked me what was going on, and I told her what had happened, what I just experienced. And, well, you know, I've told this story over many times, so this is already, I've said it this way many times, which is, it's as though I told her, like, the Martians landed outside and wanted to come in and say hello. Like, it's not that she, you know, thought I was lying or whatever. She just, like, couldn't be masig. She couldn't accept what I was saying. And, you know, this whole thing was just not in their vocabulary. Then ultimately my father came home, and, you know, of course, he was very doubtful, and he kept raising, are you sure, this, that, whatever. It just, the whole thing was just very parve and not very supportive. You know, anybody who knows my parents, they're wonderful people. It's not like, you know, this was out of any kind of rishis or anything. But, you know, that's just sort of, it all landed with a resounding thud. And, but what happened is ultimately a week and a half later, I got called by one of my father's colleagues, who is one of the Rosh Yeshiva of Tells, asked to come to his house. He sat me down, he asked me the question. He said, this is me, you know, 17 years old. Of course, I'm not married or anything, but he sat me down, asked me the question. He said, Mati, I have a question for you. Would you trust your children with Avremel Mandarovitz? That was the way he posed the question. And, of course, that was a sneistic way of him trying to figure out what had happened with me. And, of course, I looked at him in shock, because I wasn't even expecting, you know, I didn't even know why I had been called over there, but obviously my father had spoken to him, and I think it just at that point it was all starting to proverbially hit the fan. You know, I guess he fled to Eretz Yisrael right afterwards, so I think everybody was just starting to wake up to see what was going on. And so when he asked me this question, you know, it was sort of like the wrecking ball hit me in the head on the other side. Sort of the momentum swung back, and the concrete ball hit me in the head again. Because right as he asked me the question, it just sort of validated everything that I had experienced a week and a half before, that I had just spent the last week and a half doubting myself about. So, you know, once he asked me that question, I realized that something was going on, and this was a legit story. And, you know, that's basically how I came to experience the whole thing. You know, of course, very sadly, you know, there was just never any follow-up. There was no support. There was no, you know, I think just back then, you know, nobody really understood the whole Parsha, and, you know, certainly didn't understand how to, you know,
why has a number of Mandrowitz's victims who were molested by him, I don't know, sodomized or molested, I don't know exactly how far Mandrowitz went, committed suicide?
Yes, it is. I know of people. I know a number of other Mandrowitz survivors who are, you know, obviously the ones that I know are still here, but some of them are, you know, struggle with life.
Who Because we've had Steve Gluck here who talks about this suicide rate of molested children,
yes,
as well as the rate of which they ultimately become at risk and, you know, leave Orthodoxy, leave Judaism totally.
Yes, it's absolutely true. I know Zvi, he's a good man. What he said in the past with regard to all those statistics, they are 100% true. That are good, decent people, Balei Chesed, Balei Tzedakah, they'll do anything for anybody. Suddenly something comes up and one of their kids are harmed, and, you know, all of a sudden all bets are off, and, you know, they suddenly, instead of doing the right thing by their child and, you know, going to the authorities and getting the kid the right support and whatever, you know, of course it always ties into the whole shidduch situation because everybody's trying to protect their, you know, pedigree and, you know, pristine reputation and, you know, whatever. So as a result, otherwise good, decent, smart, you know, God-fearing people suddenly go off the rails and they won't say anything. And in doing so, they completely sacrifice another child, one of their children, to the Molech.
Powerful. I want to just tell you that you're a hero, that you mekayim many mitzvahs. The first one is Losame Dal Dam Riecha, which is a lav, which according to Halacha, you may have to give kol mamayne for it. According to the Gemara in Sanhedrin, you mekayim the mitzvah of Hashavas Aved as well, returning people's souls to themselves. You're also mekayim the mitzvah of Arvas, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zelazah, that we, Klal Yisrael believes that we are Shomer Achi Anochi, not like Kayin said. And since we have, you know, many thousands of listeners, and this show will get more than 10,000 listeners, you mekayim it three mitzvahs times 10,000, 30,000 mitzvahs by being here today.
Well, I mean, thank you. It's honestly, it's not about me. It's about all of us, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zebozeh. And I appreciate the sentiment. I mean, Baruch Hashem, I'm very grateful that HaKadosh Baruch Hu saw to it that I, you know, was able to survive this and put me in a position where I'm able to help others out there. I can't tell you how many countless number of people in this world, in all the years I've been doing this, how many people I just know on a personal level. And so we all have found each other and we support each other. And the only thing that I would add to your kind words was the other mida, or the other, you know, the ultimate mitzvah here that people might be doing by acknowledging what's going on and paying attention to those who've suffered through this. The argument could be made that the mitzvah that is it's like chesed shel emes. Essentially, you're being mekayim tchias hamesim here by finding somebody who's the walking dead, which a lot of people are. They're very disillusioned with ever, you know, through whatever happened to them. And if you essentially could restore life, you know, what greater mitzvah is it than that? Is there than that? And so, I feel very privileged to just, you know, be a small part of this whole thing. And it just takes a village, and it takes everybody opening up their eyes and their minds and their hearts to what's going on.
Well, thank you very much. That was Mati Weiss, a courageous, a tzaddik. I thank you very much, and I wish you much such continued hatzlacha.
Thank you.
Kol tov.